This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937, Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Housing, inflation, subprimes, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. You don't need me to remind you of the bad economic news, but here's something good. Despite sinking profits, try technology. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Society for Human Resource Management, meeting the challenges of a changing world, online at shrm.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday today, everybody, the 18th of July. So good to have you with us. There has been all manner of curious thinking in the markets this week. Stocks have been moving on expectations about expectations. Disappointments have been recast as triumphs. Just today, Citigroup announced a loss of $2.5 billion. Yet, somehow, that's a good thing. Today, Google and Microsoft gave investors something else to rethink. Turns out, even trusted technology stocks aren't immune to an economic downturn. Shares in both of those companies were hit by lackluster earnings. But tech is a big sector, and not all of it's in trouble. From the Marketplace Innovations Desk at North Carolina Public Radio, Janet Babin reports.
Google took its biggest one-day hit ever today, down almost 10%. Now it's at the bargain price of $481 a share. The internet search creator fell from grace after its CEO admitted the obvious. Eric Schmidt said on a conference call, "This is a challenging economic environment to do business in." Piper Jaffray analyst Gene Munster says, if Google's feeling the pressure, everybody is. That includes Microsoft, which also took a hit today.
If Google says something is negative, it's going to give some cover for other companies to make similar comments. And so there's just a general belief that as earnings gets ramped up next week, that we're going to hear more comments like that.
The company that's now a verb has one of the most talented tech staffs around. But analyst Martin Paikkonen with Global Crown Capital says Google's not in the tech business.
At the end of the day, in terms of running the business and how they get paid, it is through advertising.
And we all know what happens to ad budgets in a weak economy. They get cut. Firms with more of a hardware focus, like Intel and IBM, don't have that problem. Big Blue's profits were up more than 20%. MIT professor Michael Cusimano says more than half of IBM's business now comes from long-term service contracts.
When IBM comes in and takes over the information technology operations of a big company, they become entrenched in that company, and those kinds of revenues are very sticky.
A global focus also helps. Long-term, though, a broad economic slowdown sticks to most every business. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Today was a rich day to go trolling through the Securities and Exchange Commission website. Just a couple of clicks of the mouse got you this little tidbit. Freddie Mac Chairman and CEO Richard Syron's total compensation package last year came to almost $20 million. Should probably point out here the company's shares lost half their value in 2007. And speaking of shares, there was this, a request from Freddie Mac to sell $5.5 billion worth of stock. Congress is still negotiating a bailout plan for Fannie and Freddie. The companies insist they've got enough capital to cover their debts, and they're trying to avoid relying on a government handout. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports.
The day started with headlines that Freddie wants to sell as much as $10 billion in new shares to head off a government rescue. Freddie's actual filing was for a little over half that. Freddie and Fannie's stock price rose for a third straight day, which shows investors still like what they see, says Walter O'Hare, a stock analyst with the financial research firm Celent.
Once the market accepts that things are turning around, those who've taken the risk early on are rewarded.
But with a possible government takeover looming, Hans Stoll with Vanderbilt's Financial Markets Research Center says Fannie and Freddie shareholders are taking an extra gamble.
But if it comes to the situation where Freddie Mac goes under, I don't think the existing shareholders should be bailed out, which is a risk to existing shareholders or the one who would participate in this new issue.
But investors have one thing in their favor. The SEC Monday will limit the short selling of Fannie and Freddie, reducing the number of bets that the stock price will fall. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
There is nothing that makes getting dressed in the morning easier than deciding to throw on a pair of jeans. Unless you stop to think about all the different styles and cuts of denim out there. Levi Strauss announced today it's decided to start selling just one cut of its Buttonfly 501s all over the world. There will be different sizes, of course, but they're all going to have the same basic fit. No more of that relaxed fit, boot cut, low rise style, or whatever works for you. It could work for the company and save a bunch of money, too, if consumers go along. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer reports.
Levi's used to customize its 501s for various countries, taking into account different body types. But now it's unveiled its single global fit with a new media campaign called Live Unbuttoned. A Levi's video illustrates the universal cut by showing a 20-something backflip into his 501s. His friends applaud as he slides in without a scratch.
Yeah!
Retail analysts say the strategy could cut costs. Levi's could use fewer workers and machines to create the jeans. But will they fly? Howard Davidowitz is a retail consultant.
If the fit is wrong, it's all over. In other words, you immediately totally lose a sale.
But Linda Tsai of MKM Partners says uniformity could work because Levi's is using a different fabric.
The fabric probably stretches a lot, and it's got to be a cut that's more forgiving, but then also just kind of standard and generic.
But standard and generic isn't what customers have been looking for. John Kottman of advertising firm McCann Erickson says the trend has been individualism.
Brands like Nike and others let consumers design their own products, kind of mutate, if you will, what was typically a one-size-fits-all in the past.
But Kottman says jeans have a universal appeal. If Levi's is right, it could save and make money. A welcome change for a company that's been on a losing streak for years. I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
If you'd have told me on Monday all three of the major indices would finish the week higher than where they started, well, I don't think I'd have believed you. We'll have the details and the whole week on Wall Street when we do the numbers. $128.88 is what you had to pony up today to buy a barrel of crude oil. In case you haven't been keeping close track, that's almost 17 bucks lower than last Friday's close, a 13% drop. Wish I could tell you why, but I'd be making it up. It's not so secret that oil prices are tough to figure out. Figuring out why they move the way they do is sometimes more black magic than economics. The rare clear force in the global oil markets is more often referred to by its initials than its actual name, the Organization of the Petroleum Exporting Countries, OPEC. Rashir Kadakia is with Cambridge Energy Research Associates. Good to have you with us.
Great to be here. Thanks.
When you talk about oil on the global market, you sort of have to talk about OPEC. I'm wondering if you can give us a sense of how much oil you're talking about when OPEC is the subject.
You know, OPEC produces probably around 40% of the world's oil. If you look at the growth trend in oil, that percentage is diminishing. And that's largely a part of the fact that OPEC has limited spare capacity and their production isn't ramping up the way that it used to in the past.
Well, tell me about that spare capacity. What exactly does that mean?
Well, spare capacity is how much oil is available in the short term that you could ramp up. The reason why it's so significant in the price of oil and why it's such a large driver is that any type of small disruption in the market can only be met by spare capacity. For example, if a pipeline breaks down for natural reasons or there's some type of geopolitical event, whether it's between Israel and Iran or whatever it is, you know, you can't just go out and say that, okay, well, prices have been high now and we're just going to go drill more oil and that's going to fix a problem, because there's often a 5 to 10 year lead time before that supply ever hits the market. So it's a spare capacity that you can tap within a couple of months that can bring prices down.
When prices get really high and politicians get squeezed to do something about it, they often lean on OPEC. Does OPEC have the spare capacity that the world seems to think it does?
I don't think they do anymore. You know, it's a relative term when you say the world thinks what they have. You know, today OPEC has about 2 million barrels of spare capacity. I think everyone probably agrees that it's around 2 million. I think the real problem is that spare capacity has dwindled since 2004. 2 million barrels doesn't really cover the type of disruptions that we could see in this market. The market is no longer confident that OPEC can meet the needs should there be some type of disruption.
When various OPEC member countries rotate into the presidency of that organization and with that gain the power to literally move the world's oil markets by saying something or not, how carefully do they calibrate what they say?
Well, you know, irrelevant of who is the president of OPEC, at the end of the day, it's Saudi Arabia and the Saudis that are the most verbal, that have the most influence out of OPEC.
Well, if Saudi Arabia is OPEC, then what do the Saudis want to have happen with the world price of oil?
They want prices to come down drastically. That's probably a misconception out there that, you know, the Middle East wants these high prices and they're, you know, they're making a tremendous amount of money. There's no question about that. But, you know, the Saudis and OPEC in particular, they don't need this type of high price of environment, or even, you know, even our American producers, for example, or international oil companies don't need this type of price. It's just that this is the market's response to the fear that supply is not going to be able to keep up with growing demand in the Middle East, Latin America, China, and India.
Rishir Kadakia is an international oil analyst with Cambridge Energy Research Associates. Mr. Kadakia, thanks a lot for your time.
Thanks for bringing me out, Kai. I appreciate it.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
Letters begin this week with a seasonal subject, summer camps of a sort. Lots of people wrote in after Benjamin Barber's commentary about a shopping camp for girls in Louisville, Kentucky. Most found it less than wholesome. This guy from Akron, Ohio didn't have a problem with the idea so much.
You can call me Camper John.
No, Camper John Duckworth took issue with the language.
I want my word back. Camp to me means outdoors, nature, and burning wood. Call them schools, seminars, workshops. I just want people to stop calling them camps, unless the participants are likely to return home smelling a little like wood smoke.
If kids take pictures while they're at camp and put them online with Flickr, they might get picked up by Getty Images, the photo agency, perhaps with some kind of compensation involved. The deal Flickr and Getty announced last week could give wannabe photographers some exposure. But we heard from many more professional photographers and artists who said Flickr teaming up with Getty is not such a good thing. Kevin Brennan's a medical illustrator in Arlington, Massachusetts. He worries about images that get lost in the shuffle. Orphaned is the legal term.
This Flickr-Getty partnership will make it easier to orphan an artist's works. That person will have to register their copyright with a yet-to-be-determined entity.
We told you earlier this week about Rubbermaid and how it's raising prices on some of its plastic containers. Our story itself contained one well-worn assumption about plastic, that it's made with oil.
Fact is, in the United States, 70% of plastics are made from domestic natural gas, not oil.
That was Sharon Knease from the American Chemistry Council setting us straight. While I was away a couple of weeks ago, Bob Moon and Diana Nyad chatted about Wimbledon, how Americans weren't watching as much as they used to, maybe because there were no Americans in the final. They were talking specifically about the men's draw, Rafael Nadal from Spain versus Switzerland's Roger Federer. But listener tempers flared that they didn't mention the All-American Williams sisters, Venus and Serena. Lori Winchester of Anchorage, Alaska, spoke for many of you.
Are you serious? Is there still only tennis and then some short-change subset of women's tennis? I cannot even believe this complete lack of acknowledgement.
If you take issue with our hard-hitting coverage, on the court or off, drop us a line. It's marketplace.org. We're also going to be talking a lot about house and home in the next couple of weeks as part of our coverage of Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and the housing crisis. So while you're at our website, if you're in the process of buying a home or if you're just thinking about it, let us know. Click on that link that says Contact. Week on Wall Street is the topic. David Johnson is the man with the plan, or so we hope. Mr. Johnson, how are you? Oh, I'm just tickled to death to be here. I am happy. It's been a better week. You know why I'm here? You know why I'm here today?
No.
I'm here to sing the praises of Wells Fargo.
All right, go ahead.
It is like, have you ever seen The Music Man?
76 Trombones? Yeah. Yeah.
Well, but there's another song in there. The Wells Fargo wagon is a coming
right,
round.
Stop.
And everybody goes outside. They're jumping up and down. They're so excited. We had, I'm telling you, Tuesday was about as blue as it gets around here. I looked at the headlines. Everything was terrible. We wake up Wednesday morning, and here's Wells Fargo. It's a bank.
Yes.
And they reported earnings that were better than expected, and they raised their dividend, and they were optimistic about the future. And I'm dead serious. That changed everything, just like a dime. Those shorts started running for cover. They started buying stock back
left and right.
All right,
hold on. We'll get to shorts in a minute, but here's what I know. Here's what I want to know. Are you really such a pushover, you and your ilk there who do this for a living, are you such a pushover that earnings that aren't as lousy as everybody thought they were going to be are such a cause for celebration?
You ever heard the line, been so far down, bottom looks like up to me?
Yes.
Yeah, it, that's it. I mean, it just takes something. I mean, something to make you want to get up in the morning. So we had a couple of good days. Today, we didn't give it back. This would have been a classic day to turn around and give it back, and we didn't do it. And we'll see. We'll see. You know, you look back on March, it was St. Patrick's Day.
Yeah.
March the 17th that they bailed out Bear Stearns. And that was sort of a turning point in the market.
Yep.
And so maybe we're going to look back on this week at Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac Day and say, you know, that was it. That was way back in the middle of July, back in 08. Remember things were so terrible? Well, that was the bottom.
Well, let me ask you about this short selling thing that Christopher Cox, chairman of the SEC, was talking about all last week. How's that going to change the way you do business?
Not a blessed thing is going to change. That's what he's against, and I'm against, too. Is naked short selling, or if you're from Texas, it's naked short selling, which is selling a stock short that you haven't borrowed or you don't own.
That is to say, you think it's going to go down.
Well, yeah, I mean, short selling is that's the other side. Long is I think it's going to go up. Short is I think it's going to go down. I don't think, you know, their airlines are going to carry as many passengers, or they're going to make as much steel, or whatever it is. There are perfectly valid reasons for thinking a stock's going to go down, but you do have to borrow the stock. You can't just make it up, create more stock, if you will, sell stock that you don't own or you don't have access to. So that's always been illegal. So I don't know. I guess it's more illegal now than it used to be.
Well, so do you think the SEC is grandstanding here and just trying to stop the panic, if you will?
I think so. I love short sellers because they all have to run and buy their stock back at one time, and it causes the Dow to go up 475 points in 2 days, like yesterday and the day before that.
David Johnson down in Dallas, Texas. Thank you, David.
Have a good weekend, Kai.
You too. Coming up, for some retailers, man, life's a beach.
And what we're seeing from our store, we have a great big door that rolls up, which when we look out, we see a postcard.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials nudged up 0.4% today, 49 points to close at 11,496. The Nasdaq slumped 1.25%, 29 points, finished at 2282. The Nasdaq did. The S&P 500 flat mostly, ended the day at 1264. The week that was, the Dow shot up 3.5%, its best week in 3 months, by the way. The Nasdaq gained 1%, almost 2%. The S&P 500 rose 1.7%. A slew of tech stocks paid the price for releasing poor quarterly numbers. Google clicked down almost 10%. Microsoft plunged 6%, and Advanced Micro Devices chipped off 12%. IBM was one of the sector's few bright spots. Big Blue picked up 2.75%. Citigroup, as I mentioned, surprised the street when it reported a loss of $2.5 billion, much less than analysts were anticipating. A good surprise, I guess. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 4.09%, and you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Clarkson Potter's The Splendid Tables How to Eat Supper, the cookbook inspired by the radio program for people who love to eat, available now. Whether you're busy or lounging around, the economic gears are always turning. Marketplace is available around the clock, too, as a podcast. Get your financial fix whenever you want it. Download the show and take it with you. just head over to our website at marketplace.org and click on podcasts.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at the events for Monday. President Bush hosts a dinner for past and present United States Olympians. The Airports Council Convention begins. Topics include environmental standards and funding for airport improvement. And on July 21st, 1969, Neil Armstrong took a walk on the moon. It was, as he well noted, one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind. I'm Megan Larson.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. The Olympics start 3 weeks from today, and as the games get ready to begin, a whole lot of business in Beijing is grinding to a halt. Hundreds of factories are going to be shut down to clear the air. Half the city's cars have been ordered to stay home. It can be tough to turn a profit when the rules are changing like that, but here's the thing. The rules in China always change, and business types there who've been around the block know it. Marketplace's Scott Tong reports from Beijing.
The best pizza in town comes from a joint called the Crow's Nest, so say the foreigner crowd.
Green peppers, olives, onions, pepperoni.
Store manager Will Bernholtz ticks off a fan favorite on the menu, the Crow Special. But starting this weekend, the Crow's Nest will become an empty nest by government decree. The restaurant sits right next to the heavily protected Olympic soccer stadium. Ergo, security risk.
We have been notified through channels that we would be closing during the Olympics because the worker stadium area is a safety zone.
The Crow's Nest has no choice in this matter, so it stands to lose thousands of dollars in business throughout the Olympics.
That's one thing we're used to here in China. And in China, you have to stay flexible and be ready for the government to tell you that you need to do something differently, and you got to cooperate to operate.
Cooperate to operate. Because in this Olympic season, security comes first. In fact, China brags that it's built, quote, the most strict prevention and control system in the history of the games. As of Sunday, every single car entering Beijing will get checked for outsiders. Large commercial trucks will be banned from the city center, and most billboards have been removed.
The landscape has literally been denuded of advertising.
That's marketing consultant David Wolf. He's not that surprised, because in his view, the rules in China always change. For instance, factories that export once enjoyed big tax breaks until they got taken away and then restored again. Foreign investors, once wooed, now see many of their deals canceled. And the heads of Chinese state-owned companies can be here today, gone tonight. In each case, the central government has a higher purpose. But for the business community, abrupt shifts can create corporate casualties.
China's the Vietnam War of American business.
Again, David Wolf.
We've sent more young, promising careers home in body bags than almost anything since the fall of Saigon. It's kind of a morbid way of thinking about it, but it really is true. And the people who do get sent home in body bags don't get the rhythm of the way business is done here.
China veterans have developed a host of survival skills. Get good information on when the goalposts will move, as they often do. Explain to headquarters that China's different. It's an unpredictable emerging market that sometimes defies common sense. And learn to count to 10. Try to relax. If all else fails, try what pizza maker Will Bernholtz does. When the rules change, just spout the party line. In Chinese.
And it's all like the Chinese say, wei ren min fu wu. It's all in service of the people, so we at the Crow's Nest are also taking part in that attitude.
Consider it a cost of doing very good business in a country whose authoritarian roots are still showing. In Beijing, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Remember summer vacations at the beach, maybe hanging out on the boardwalk, and those T-shirts your parents bought you? The ones with the goofy sayings on them or cats outlined in glitter? Well, that brings us to today's installment of Hot Jobs.
We're having a heat wave.
The retail business can be tough, but it's much easier to take when you're selling T-shirts at the beach and you're only doing it 3 months out of the year, like this entrepreneurial couple in Ocean City, Maryland.
It's called a heat press machine.
Because it heats and it presses at the same time, but it's a heat press. It's for decaling. My name is Margaret Pillis.
And I'm Margaret's husband, Perry Pillis.
We are retailers on the boardwalk in Ocean City, Maryland. We have a baby store, but we're family. We can fit somebody from 6 months old all the way up to 90 years old.
My daily routine is I pop up at 6 in the morning, take my shower, open up by 8, stay here the whole day until about 11:30 in the evening, and go back home and start the day over the next morning the same way.
It's a very good life because you can imagine in 100 days we make our living to last us the 265 other days.
You have your staples that you're going to sell every summer. You're going to sell your buckets and shovels. You're going to sell your hats to children. You're going to sell basic T-shirts, suntan lotion, sunglasses. People were not coming to the beach for things they could pretty much get at home a lot of times.
You know, when people come up to the press to get something on, you hear me say, you want Ocean City on this or not? 99% of the people say put Ocean City on it.
Business was my major in school. And I said, geez, I'd like to take a crack at it, and dropped out of law school and bought a business on the boardwalk 40 years ago, and that's what I've been doing since 1968.
And what we're seeing from our store, we have a great big door that rolls up, which when we look out, we see a postcard, a beach postcard. There's umbrellas, chairs, so it helps Perry and I, who are here, you know, long hours, to feel that we are on vacation at the same time looking at something really beautiful. I mean, can you imagine?
I've been doing this so long, it's hard to think of something other than this that I would be doing. But I guess being at the beach all my life, it would probably be something related to being at the beach. Probably I'd turn into a cabana boy at one of the beach stands, just hanging out.
He'd keep his tan.
Elizabeth Wynn Johnson helped us out with that report. You can see a picture of Margaret and Perry in their shop, OC Babies, Kids and Adults, at our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing a wide range of tax-exempt portfolios. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note to send you into the weekend may be something to inspire you to get up off the couch and just do it. Nike's famous slogan, just do it, turns 20 this year. Next month, in fact. The company's parlaying the anniversary in some smart marketing to take advantage of the Beijing Olympics, too. You see, Nike's not an official sponsor of the games, but the swoosh is still going to be on uniforms all over the place in Beijing. And the 20th anniversary ad campaign launches worldwide tomorrow. Not in this country, though, with its big television audience until the day the games actually begin. And on this Friday, that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow bumped up 49 points, 0.4%. The NASDAQ dipped 29 points, 1.25%. The S&P 500 traded flat to wrap up at 1260. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer is JJ Yore. Coming up on Monday, the other ways that candidates can raise money.
It's like having a little cash register, a little bank account at their beck and call.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's our special series, Pac-Men. Have yourself a great weekend.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.